Is that you whistling or is that the birdies whistling?
That is the birdies whistling here in Southwest Cork.
Welcome to the podcast, and I'm really excited to talk yurts with you and to
Fantastic.
maybe hear a little bit about who you are first, and then we'll get into the yurts conversation.
Yeah, pleasure to be here, Michael. So Dathi Nevin is my name. Born in Leixlip, grew up around Dublin for a number of years, but I moved down to Cork in 2006, and I've been down here amongst all my travelling. I've been down here since then. I came down here to study a 2-year permaculture and practical sustainability course, so that was a big part of my life during a number of years. But since then, I've done a lot of things. Involved in the festival scene in Ireland in different ways as a therapist and setting up areas and that, and also creating permaculture type sites. Trained as a shiatsu therapist. I've trained recently in shamanic counseling and training, which I'm working with people one-to-one on that at the moment. And yeah, in the last few years, I bought some land at Lake Atitlan in Guatemala. So I spend quite a chunk of my life over there at the moment, running different retreats and, I do a lot of music and kirtan and medicine song circles and just a lot of things, Michael, to be honest. And in somewhere in all that, I began to make yurts as well, and that's been something I've been doing for about 5 years as well. So yeah, it's a little bit
Well,
about myself.
beautiful. Really nice to get to know a little bit more about where you came from or where you've been coming from. Because in 2006, how old were you in 2006 when you did the permaculture training?
I was about 27.
Okay. Wow, you looked a lot younger than you are. I haven't done the maths in my head, but that means you're more than 40.
Than 40, yeah. I'll be 44 in about 4 weeks.
Okay, so our scheduled podcast for 444 had a bit of a link to something.
Absolutely, yeah.
Did you do your shamanic training with in Dundurry Park with Martin Duffy?
Funny enough, the first ever workshop I did was 2001 with Martin Duffy in my hometown, Leixlip. And between the jigs and the reels last year and doing many things in the meantime, I finally got around to doing the practitioner training with him and then continued on to do the shamanic counseling course with him. So it's always been a part of my life in those 23 years or so, but kind of formalizing it and getting more training in that way actually just happened last year. But it was with Martin and Annette in Dundurry, yeah.
Did you, if you do have a drum already, did you receive it in Guatemala or did you receive it in Ireland?
Oh, definitely in Ireland. Yeah, drum. Although my rattle I got on the continent, actually, the current rattle I use. Although I have about four of them. One of them I stumbled upon in a secondhand shop in West Cork. One of those real authentic turtle shell rattles. I didn't know what I was holding at the time, but I do now. But my drum, I actually made my drum in a workshop in Cork about 3 years ago. So I still use that one. And I actually purchased one recently as well.
Beautiful. And the turtle shell rattle is a literal turtle shell with what inside it?
It's got little stones inside, and the only reason I know that is because I very stupidly I brought it to one of those climate protests in the streets of Cork a number of years ago. And when I was cycling home after it, I had it in a bag on the handlebar of my bike, and it clipped off one of the spokes, so it put a little crack in the rattle. So I was obviously not ready yet to kind of own a rattle like that. I felt like that was the message. So it cracked open and I got to see what was inside. But there's some small little crystally stones. But it's quite an object, this rattle. It's the handle is the leg of a hooved animal, probably some kind of a deer. And then it's got feathers and it's but I still use it. I couldn't for the heart of me not just keep it on my altar, you know. It's too precious. But yeah.
I understand. What I heard when you said that there was, you put a crack in the rattle from not maybe treating it with the respect that it deserves. However, maybe there's a sign in that as well to have a bit of crack with the rattle, and maybe that it's maybe the sacred's not as serious or solemn as it sometimes can be. That it can have a bit more of maybe that's what Ireland's teaching me at the moment is that the crack is a bit more curvaceous than the maybe. the purity that I bring to it sometimes by accident in my holiness that may have come from a bit of indoctrination that is coming through me. So I think I feel it's good when we get those signs to loosen up a little bit, or those kinds of things.
I appreciate that perspective, because that awareness is more so present now. At the time, I just felt bad about it, but now, I couldn't agree more, Michael. I love to bring humor into, especially within the spiritual realms and communities.
Too fucking right.
We must not take ourselves too seriously.
definitely not. I feel like we've got a little bit of the essence of you, which we could talk about for absolutely hours, and I feel we could dive into literally 10 different topics there easily that I have resonance with and my own experiences with, and I'd only love to dive into it. But the focus of this conversation will be yurts, and I feel like the listeners now will have a little bit of a feeling, kind of a feeling of what you're about, and I have some very functional questions after receiving your PDF on the yurts mm-hmm. that you provide to people with your business, and which I would feel, being the person you are, it would be a conscious business. Would you call it a conscious business?
I yes, in a sense, yeah, I will, because originally what brought me to yurt making was because I actually wanted to create a space to run workshops, and that, so it kind of was born out of that initial gem. You know, but yeah, in terms of materials I use and that, to the best of my ability and how I work, yes.
And would you feel that would you be able to use the word conscious capitalism in it? Or would you feel you're capitalizing in a conscious way?
You know, it's one, the yurt making is... It's as part to nourish my love of actually just working with my hands and that, but it's one of a number of different ways I go about kind of navigating the money part of the world and that, and making some money. It's one amongst many. So it's not, that will come clear in the conversation. It's not my main driving passion and means of making money either. With conscious capitalism, what I can say is that it ticks boxes for me in terms of how I like to work and to be my own boss and things like that. That's more what's important to me.
Beautiful. We can maybe jump back in there as we talk about maybe a bit more of the details. And the biggest questions that come up for me were the yurt being, I'll maybe bring in my own opinion in a little bit. I feel that the yurt is a great opportunity to dwell in a piece of land, to begin the journey of the communion or relationship with the land, into getting to know the elements and what's around you and the animals and the plants and how you connect with it, to see how you move with it, with a temporary structure that isn't destructive, that can have a light footprint on the land until you get to know us and to see how things flow, where the animals move, where the animals have their babies, where the winds blow, where the rain blows, where the sun shines, to get to know your land. And I feel the yurt is a great opportunity for virgin land. And also, I'm using the word virgin land because I've been watching way too many TV documentaries sit in my recovery with this halo vest. So I may be using some words that I've picked up from RTE, so excuse me. And I feel that the yurt, for example, with the piece of land that I'm in a journey with at the moment in Eden Heart Space in Knock in Ireland, we're building a sauna as the first building this September with Ashley, a lady who's your neighbor in Sununa in Lake Atitlan, Ashley McDonald. Oh, okay. So she's facilitating the course down in Knock. And our sauna is going to be our first building. However, the yurt is a possibility for me in terms of having a place for ceremony, for yoga, for shelter. There's infinite potentials of what it could be, because there's so many needs. People need to shower. Yeah. People need to need a compost toilet. People need shelter from the rain. People need a place of solace to relax in the building, to integrate this journey of connection with nature. There's so many needs that a yurt can provide. My wonders are the floor and the fire. And they're the only two things that in your PDF are things that you invite people to explore with you further, with further communication. So that was my main trigger to record this conversation, because I knew we were going to lift off into beautiful information, and I wanted other people to get the opportunity to listen in and receive this information, which would be the only things that I would feel aren't clear to me purchasing a yurt or for me recommending a yurt.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. So I don't provide or make the actual floors myself, but I've worked with guys who've made them. And so it's always one of the main questions for anybody buying a yurt. And it's always based on what's your intended use for the yurt, i.e. how long it's going to be up at any time, and what activities are going to be on inside it. I've used yurts where it's just quick setups, and a festival context is where I would put down a heavy duty kind of plastic matting and then carpet over that. And that's absolutely fine during the summer months when the weather is warm, or if it's just temporary events or workshops or anything like that. It's actually quite a fine floor to work off. So there's temporary ones you can do. But if it's going to be a more permanent structure, even for a number of months, or if you're going to be running a bit more high-end workshops and that, then a floor is obviously a big plus. Do you want me to talk a little bit about what the options are on the flooring?
Maybe I've kind of got a feel for the temporary aspect of the plastic floor and the carpet and all that lies in between there. Yeah. I would wonder if we were setting up, for example, now in September for the course, and that structure will be staying there through the winter, and we don't know how the water flows in the winter yet, and of a permanent fixtured floor that would probably end up being taken up, what would the options be then?
So it's going to be, like, obviously water is a main thing. So determining how the water is moving and what kind of protection the inside of the earth is going to need from it. You would, so let's say you're making basically you're building a deck. Anybody who's seen a wooden decking, I mean, most every yurt, or if you go to glamping places, you'll see them sitting up on a raised deck. So it's exactly the same steps as if you were building a square deck. But also with yurt, because it's a round structure, you don't often see round decks, but the way guys have done it for me before is they actually build a round deck, and it's in pie kind of slices, so like 9 slices of pie that are all individually made, and then literally like constructing a circle out of each of the segments that are all after can be individually taken out as well. So it's all the work is kind of pre-done in the workshop, and then the actual assembly would be one day on site. And it's essentially that. It's a wooden, a round wooden floor, and finishing it can be anything from thick 3/4-inch plywood with insulation underneath. If it's up during the winter, underfloor insulation is going to be pretty important. It's quite a bonus because a lot of cold can seep up from there. But yeah, that's... and then if water or anything like that was not an issue, you could really just dig down into the subsoil and put in a compacted sub base of gravel, and then top it off, or even top it off with cement or something like that. If water was an issue and you wanted it raised up off the ground, which has other benefits, then you're obviously, you know, you're just putting in posts in the ground, cross beams across the post, and then building, you know, basically building a web of wood, and then building the floor on top of that, be it permanent or be it again the pie slices. So yeah, it's all very site specific. I know a friend of mine whose budget was, who's living in it long term over the winter and summer, but her budget was low, so she put together a floor using a lot of found materials. She used pallets and cheaper plywood. You know, it's always based on what your budget is and what you want to invest in it, you know.
So what I'm seeing is, you've explained the flooring so well, now I'm like seeing the walls rise, and the two things I'm seeing is the potentiality of a yurt being the egg inside your home that you're building, that you take down when your house is built, and
potentially, yeah.
And I'm seeing also so you're insulating the floor, and then your walls and your roof are going to be letting in you're going to be losing your heat from your fire in the middle. So maybe we go straight to the fire in case we don't get there. What are the options of the fire in the middle of the room with the chimney going up through the middle, which is what you talk about in your PDF?
Yeah. So it's basically a stove, a simple wood burning stove. And there is specifically ones designed and made for yurt situations or for large tents. And for the one, the yurts I'd be selling, they're 16 foot diameter. So that's 4 meters for 88. And it's actually quite a small stove required to heat a space like that. You know, it's not one of these big wide stoves. So basically any wood burning stove, and then just your typical flue pipe. And the stove can be set up actually anywhere in the yurt, because the flue pipe that comes out the back of the stove can go out sideways out of the wall canvas. It can go straight up at any part of the roof, or it's more in the bigger yurts, I would have said, where they send it straight up through the middle, which is the crown wheel. In the center of the yurt, there's a crown wheel, which can be opened. It's got a separate PVC clear cover over it that can be taken and put back on at any time. So basically, yeah, simple wood burning stove, your flue pipe. There's very readily available these attachments that you can get. It's basically two metal discs that go either side of the canvas and connect it together, and they create a safe kind of seal and barrier around the hot pipe of the stove. Obviously, you don't want that touching your canvas. But that's a simple installation. It's as simple as cutting out the shape and bolting in the pieces of metal that come with it.
How do you remove that plastic flap on the top of the roof? I'm not seeing. Can you do it from the inside or from the outside?
It's from the outside. So it's if you look at most every yurt, you'll see, of course, you have your wall canvas, you have your roof canvas, and then often you'll see this kind of star, like triangles coming down over the roof. So that's all, those triangles and stars are connected to a separate cover that sits over the crown wheel. And it's just, it's aesthetics. Those star shapes are kind of aesthetics. It looks very nice. And at the bottom of each of those triangles is a rope that is connected down onto a peg on the ground, or even onto the wall structure of the yurt. And so it's as simple as just untying maybe 6 knots and then just pulling it off the roof. And putting it back on is literally just pulling it back up with the ropes again. It would take about 2 minutes to take it off and 6 minutes to put it back on. It's a very quick job.
And can you take off one that just takes off the circle part in the roof? So I'm not visualizing the metal piece that goes around the flue that sits on the canvas. Once that's there, that's a permanent fixture and you won't be flapping open and closing, am I right? The flap
exactly
would only be there if you don't have the chimney.
Yeah, and that's why, absolutely. And that's why what I recommend and what I always say with the stoves is, and the pipe, is that it actually comes out, that it doesn't go through the center wheel for that exact reason. That's why it's more, that's why I'm saying it's more in the much bigger size yurts, where they actually most often will have a permanent plastic kind of like a dome covering it. So it's not removable. That's not the kind of yurt I make.
The only thing hearing about the flue coming out the side is, from my own failures, is the pull on the stove, not having enough pull to actually have the fire going and then having smoke around your yurt. Have you experience with the flues coming out the sidewalls?
Yeah, most I've seen yurts with that, and of course there's it comes out the side, and then there's an L shape connector to the flue, so it goes directly up.
Okay.
It would need to go directly up. Yeah, absolutely.
I'm hearing you. And with the fire energy, so when we're talking about the roof, we've got multiple stairs on the roof. So if I take back one flap, is that taking part the whole flap from the center all the way to the wall, and you'll have a big gap opened up inside your yurt? Is that the idea of it, or
no? So that star is that's separate to the roof canvas. It's a separate piece.
I'm here.
So the roof canvas is always covering the roof unless you take it off. The star is separate.
That's, so you lose your star option if you went for your flue up straight through the middle. I'm hearing you now. Okay, yeah.
Unless you create some kind of a permanent membrane that the stove goes through the middle.
Yes. Okay.
You know what I mean? So that you don't have to.
Have you experience with people building their yurts and then moving on to building a house around it? And has that ever happened in your experience?
Not building a house around it. People have extended. You can basically keep going into infinity, but you can build rooms off a yurt by just simply opening up the wall. So I've seen yurts where there's a main central large yurt, and then off the side you could have actually separate rooms, basically smaller yurts that you enter from that main yurt. So I've seen that in order to extend it. I've even seen 2 and 3 story yurts. That's not a project I have taken on yet, but in terms of building a house around it, no, I wouldn't see that as even a good idea or necessary. You know, I think a yurt is a yurt and it has its uses.
And how have the yurts dealt with our west of Ireland winds and rain in your experience being down in Cork? I'm sure you've been down in West Cork with yurts, haven't you?
Oh yeah, I've seen them in a number of different places. With the winds, wind is a major factor. So yeah, you absolutely want to strap the yurt down. And that's as simple as if you see those, pretty heavy, you could either use good strong rope, as long as it's connected into a stake or something in the ground, whatever it is that's permanent. A lattice of maybe 6 of those ropes going over the yurts. And that would only be necessary to put in when you know there's going to be a storm or over the winter. I wouldn't have that permanently there. So that will hold it down fine. Other people, if they want to get a bit more heavy duty, they'll actually use ratchet straps. So you see in the big trucks with the tarpaulin covers, they strap it all down or on the back of any truck. So that will, but yeah, it is, if a wind gets in under the canvas, I mean, that's a lot of surface area that a wind can lift it. So yeah, it is a factor. With the rain and that, so what we use, and most every yurt you would find in the UK, they're all using a product, a material that was developed kind of specifically for the UK or Ireland kind of environment. It's a product called Regentex, and it comes in different rate ratios. Just think of it as the thickness of the material. Regentex is a mixture of cotton and polyester. It's polycotton. And then it's treated as well. So it's got it's treated for fire, water, and rot proof. You can then, every couple of years is the recommendation, it'd be about a 1 day of work that you would actually get the product and retreat it. Now, it's not an exact science. I know other yurt makers, and they've gone back to visit yurts that they made themselves after 7 or 8 years that were left up, not even lived in the winter, and the canvas is still looking good. So it's where you position your yurt and all this, and different factors are going to determine how long the canvas lasts. But essentially, they say 6 or 7 years, if it's looked after, before you would even need to think about replacing the canvas again.
So wow, you might think there's infinite possibilities in the yurts. Even as you're speaking about it, I'm seeing all the potentials of gaps in my world and gaps in my people that I'm connected to this world, where yurts could be so supportive. And my wonder now is, and it doesn't make any sense why I'm going there, but the branches of the trees that you're working with to frame structure yurt, what's their journey? Where are you receiving these trees from?
So originally, let's say I'm probably 6 years now making yurts. My original inspiration was during the permaculture practical sustainability course. And my first ever experience with yurt making was a field trip where we actually made one of the walls of a yurt. And traditionally, they were they used hazel, which is quite widespread in Ireland. But so they use hazel because hazel, you can harvest very sustainably through a process called coppicing. It's a well-known sustainable woodland management system, and it involves cutting down the branches essentially of the hazel to ground level, and then every 7 years, and then it replenishes. So you're not killing the tree, you're just harvesting the product. It's actually very beneficial to the tree. So hazel, that you would have tradition actually planted coppices where it was these trees were grown specifically for this use and this management technique, but we don't really have them in Ireland. I know of two or three, but it's kind of a lost craft. But hazel, in certain parts of Ireland, let's say the Burren and other areas, is very widespread, just wild growing. The Burren used to, Ireland, in fact, used to be predominantly hazel. That was the main, the first main tree to kind of dominate. I know in old pollen samples, it's like can be 96% hazel they find. So there's still a lot of hazel in Ireland. And for my initial 4 years of making yurts, I would go in the winter harvesting hazel. So it's quite a process, but hazel has to be harvested. The coppicing season is from November till March. And since 2001, I have been spending October until May in Guatemala. So I haven't actually been here for the coppicing season. So in the last couple of years, I have been using timber, just normal white pine or white deal timber. It's easy enough to source it, obviously, from any timber merchant. And it's basically, you know, it's harvested under the standard as a Forestry Alliance, FSA, I can't remember the exact Forestry Standard Alliance and that. So it is not as sustainable as the hazel yurts I was making. But just in the last couple of years, I have been in a position to harvest it. So it's also quite a lot of work, I must say. It was a real labor of love heading off into the wilds of the Burren and harvesting several hundred hazel poles over the winter months as well. But yeah, I just haven't been doing it the last few years.
How were you traveling with your hazel branches, and where were you traveling to?
So I always had a van, and generally I would, you know, seek out my, during the summer, I often spend time anyway around the Burren. You know, I'm on the road quite a bit. So I would kind of tip away seeking out my spots that I knew I'd be returning to in the winter to harvest. And then it was just a case of trying to find a park up spot as close as possible, find a landowner, and fingers crossed, get permission. Up there, hazel is actually considered a noxious weed. It's basically encroaching on land where they graze their sheep and that, you know. So I never felt like I was actually in there taking something that was valuable to the landowners. In fact, they put energy into clearing the hazel. But I would basically transport it then from the Burren down to my workshop in Southwest Cork. And then it's kind of, the time is ticking then, because you need to, the first process with the hazel poles is stripping off the bark with a special tool called a draw knife, and it needs to be done while the bark is still, the sap is still kind of in it. But then it's as easy as running a knife through butter, but when it starts to dry out the bark on the hazel, it's a whole other kettle of fish. So, but it's a very, very relaxing, beautiful job. You just sit down and you're just stripping off all this hazel bark from the poles. And then after it, I would have this huge amount of beautiful hazel bark, and I was just using it as mulch on my paths or under trees. And my housemate at the time was actually making inks wild, making dyes, you know, natural inks out of wild, all sorts of wilds, basically. Hedgerow Ink Company is her project. And so she started making inks and dyes out of the hazel bark, which was quite extraordinary.
So what you just explained is the literal essence you've captured of natural building for me. And I understand why you have chosen to go for white deal and to go for pine. And you've caught me in a moment in my life where I'm not sitting on the judgment seat. And I do understand. And it's, if anything, it's only you that's not getting to go on the journey with Hazel, because it's like, it's in a way, it's like a romantic adventure. It's absolutely gorgeous. And I resonate with that journey because I do a lot of pointless labors for love myself. Well, what seem pointless. However, it's what usually opens up me to me, and nature to me. And I love the pointless adventures. And it makes me wonder how I can personally develop these networks and relationships with custodians and guardians of the land who do maybe see the Hazel as something that's not working with their vision of their land, and that they would let me coppice the Hazel and the Willow. And is Willow also a material that was used anciently with building techniques?
100%, yeah. I mean, the willow, that's more Watland doll than willow was more. Well, of course, it was it wouldn't have the, it would certainly have the pliability, but it wouldn't have the strength of the hazel poles. But in terms of green building, I mean, Watland daub, where you need to create some kind of a wooden structure just initially to get your daub, which is the cob and that, and the earth, something for it to connect onto it before it dries. Willow would be perfect for that. But in terms of yurt making, definitely not willow.
And
definitely not.
The white deal that you're working with now, does that timber bend naturally, or do you need to clamp it to bend to the shapes that you desire?
So there's different styles of yurt making, and the traditional Mongolian was bent pole. But you know, yurts have kind of moved on a lot now, and so it's actually the specific West Yurt Company, I think, were kind of one of the first big ones in the West that started to make yurts for the Western world, let's say. They actually started to develop this straight pole yurt making technique. So yeah, I follow that. It's all straight poles, bum bum bum. So there's no steam bending involved. Yeah.
We're coming to near the end of our allotted 30 minutes for this call, and I want to keep it at that so it's very receivable and digestible to the listener. And I would love to continue this conversation because I'm only starting to fire up with so many questions about yurts and the connections of yurts. But I will share this as a part one of my conversation. Right. Do you like to be known? What is your surname? What surname do you like to be shared? Is it? I won't say. Are you telling me what your surname is?
Well, I mean, it's on the screen there, but Nevin is my surname, my given surname, Akinavian. But I guess I've been going as Dahi Sol, which I guess is linking in a bit of my connection with the Spanish speaking world. But yeah, I will answer to both.
Beautiful. And for anyone listening, Sol is light in Espanol. Am I
Sol
right?
Sol is light. Sol is sun. Yeah.
Sol is sun. Beautiful. Thank you for entertaining this conversation and enlightening me and the listeners on your journey with yurts. And I'm coming away with more questions than I began with. Yes, it'll open up now as I go to the land. And for me, as someone who's interested in purchasing a yurt from you, I'm going to go visit the land and have a look around and see if it's what's required. And maybe our next conversation we can record again, and we will be able to document this journey of how I move with you with the yurt, and that way others will be able to listen in as well.
Fantastic. I love it. Sounds great.
Thanks, Di. Pleasure speaking to you.
Pleasure, Michael. Take care,
bye-bye.
Brother.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.